It's time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 30th of June 2012. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday from 10 to 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneroa. On Saturday the 30th of June, Sharon Brown had an extended interview with Waitemata and Hauraki Gulf Islands Councillor Mike Lee.
Okay, well, just when I thought I'd got rid of Michael, he's back again.
It's cold outside.
Yeah, that's right. It seemed a bit cold to be out there with a petition board. You'd much rather be inside the warm radio station. So I guess then we don't know if Alan's showing up, so we'll just play devil's advocate for him. Do you know why the government thinks it's a good idea to have asset sales?
There are lots of people's opinions as to why the government feels that asset sales are good. I tend to believe it's ideological, that the National Party faith believes that the government shouldn't own anything and that everything should run like a business. You can see that in their desire to turn schools into little businesses with bonuses for high-performing principals and larger class sizes for greater efficiencies. The whole neoliberal agenda of privatising everything and making everything user pays and doing away with the notion of a community. However, if you were to look at it from a purely economic point of view, it's still a dumb decision. These companies are good companies, and whilst the government is in a lot of debt, these companies return a higher rate of return than the cost of the debt that they may be used to repay. We also don't know that what the government really intends to do with the money it collects from this, whether it will go to retiring debt or whether it will go to regular expenses. Now, I've run a business in the past, and I know some of you out there run businesses. You don't pay ongoing costs with one-off payments. It's not how you run a business. And you also don't sell your income-generating assets to pay off debt, especially when the income generated is at a higher rate than the cost of the debt. So it doesn't seem to make economic sense. It doesn't make sense for the sake of community. We know from experiences in other places that once state-owned electricity generators and distributors are sold off, costs invariably go up. When shareholder value is deemed more important than providing warmth and heat and electricity to the people.
I have to say that's one of the things that really concerns me, is playing with things like electricity, water, basic needs of life, and playing with them as though they are commodities that can be speculated upon. And I think someone was telling me about a study that had been done in Wellington. Did you ever see anything on that? Something about how the power company in Wellington had been sold three or four times, and in each sale it had obviously been sold for more and more money, and so the cost of electricity had risen, and yet their basic assets hadn't changed in the process. So they were buying and selling the same thing, but the value of it had sort of been speculated upon. Yeah, sorry.
It is concerning, especially when you think about the vulnerable in our society that could be left out. There are people whose lives depend on electricity if they're plugged into equipment, and these people may be in financial stress. And if the power company cuts them off, then there's potentially lives in danger. Now, that is taking it to its extreme, but we do need to think about the real effects of having more expensive power and electricity companies being run for profit rather than for the community.
Cheers. Okay, I'm on radio. Bye.
Thanks, Sharon.
Oh, jeez. Okay, that was Peter Stavelli saying she would be late, so I missed the end of that, but I'm sure it was very interesting. And, okay, any other thoughts on asset sales? I mean, I think the other issue is one of the things that was used as an excuse to sell assets, certainly in England, was the notion that nationalised industry underperforms, and therefore if things are run according to a business model, then they perform so much better and you get rid of the fat and et cetera, et cetera. But again, I understand there have been studies commissioned by the government in New Zealand to say that the companies that they investigated, which were the power companies, were running to maximum efficiency anyway. So there wasn't anything to be gained in terms of efficiency, whether it was private or public.
That's true. And when you're talking about things like electricity, these things are a monopoly. And privatising a monopoly is really giving up a lot of control and placing yourself in a very dangerous situation. Selling a company which has got competition and which can have those tempering forces of the market to keep prices down is different from selling a monopoly, and the prices go up and they go up for all the companies. There's not much you as a consumer can do about it. And yes, as you say, the companies are already running at maximum efficiency according to reports, and so there's not much that can be gained in that regard from the
one of the other issues as well, as I understand it, is that as a state-owned enterprise, people have the right to put in official information questions around things that they're interested in. However, as a private business, there's a risk that changes and the public are no longer able to ask questions of these companies. And I think a lot of them also operate in a way that's kind of beyond the law. I know with like telecommunications, there have been a whole load of things around cell phone towers going up on land that was public, but now in a sense the conditions of the use of land mean that decisions can be made based on what the lease or the ownership of the land was before, and maybe that needs to be taken into account again. Sorry, I'm not expressing that very well, but
no, I understand. Companies, you know, companies that generate profit to a certain extent need to have a level of confidentiality around their operations, commercial sensitivity. So if the assets were to be sold and run as private companies, then their accountability and their transparency would suffer. You almost touched on another very important point there, and that's that state-owned enterprises are subject to te tiriti o waitangi conditions, and if they were to be sold, then those conditions are taken away. And these power companies control, in some instances, how water flows, because they generate power from hydroelectricity. They own they manage significant sections of land. So there are lots of treaty considerations to be taken into that I'm not sure have been fully explored and developed. And the implications are potentially quite strong.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I hadn't thought about that side of things. Okay, great. Was there anything else you wanted to say around asset sales? I mean, I know the other issue is, I know John Key, in an interview with on Campbell Live earlier this week, was saying something like the mum and dad investors would benefit from this whole situation. But John Campbell pointed out that there were only 10% of the population who were actually investing in anything, and there was a risk that even if they did invest, it would only be a small percentage of the population, and thereafter there was also the risk that 2 years down the line they would just resell this to whoever.
That's right. I've had friends say to me, well, how about we sell the assets but only to New Zealanders? And unfortunately, when you put items on the stock exchange, you can't control who buys them and then who they sell them onto forwards in the future. Look, New Zealand is a low wage economy, and there is not enough capital floating around to invest in all of the things that New Zealand needs. And so, if things go onto the free market exchange, then inevitably the money that comes in to buy it is from overseas. Now, mum and dad investors may well buy a small part of it, but institutional investors are most likely to be the the main purchasers. Now, these are the large speculative companies that threw the world into the economic crisis that we're currently in now, and this is who we want to hand over control of our assets to. That doesn't sound sensible to me, and I think that what we need to remember is that all the mums and dads of New Zealand already own these companies. We already own them, and they are income-producing companies that provide a public service and generate a bit of income back to the government.
Mm, yeah, indeed. And I think, I guess it's quite interesting because it is an ideological rift, isn't it, on where you see the role of government. And, you know, in a neoliberal approach, you see the role of no government. But I don't know, that seems, you know, for me, the whole point about government is that you make sure that you're generating enough income to have good public education, good healthcare for everyone, you protect the weaker members of society. So
that's right. I mean, I feel, and I think a lot of people do too, that there's more to society than just the economy. And I believe that we live in a community. It's one of the reasons I moved to this island, to live in a community. And that's where people look after each other and not just defend their own self-interest at the expense of everyone else. That, to me, sounds like a very sad and hopeless, helpless society. And I don't like it when I see us drifting towards that kind of situation. Yes, we should live in a community. I don't believe that the government should be involved in every aspect of our life, but having a government there to look after the weak and to support us and to defend our rights, that's the kind of community and the kind of New Zealand I want to live in.
Oh, lovely. Well, Michael, thank you so much, and good luck with the asset sales referendum petition.
Wakey Radio.
Welcome, Mike. Thanks for coming on the show.
Good morning, Sharon. Great being here.
Yes, no, great, good, lovely. Okay, well, I'm very excited because I'm talking about late adopter. I've just got really interested in Facebook, and so for this week's show, I posted up what would people like to hear, and then when I knew that you were going to come on, I asked people again, you know, what kinds of questions they had for you. So I'm just going to start with those questions, and there's a question here from Andy Spence. What can be done about the increasing use of minor effects for elements of a development being used by planners as a justification to allow a development to those effects as far from being minor when taken as a whole? Okay, I don't know if you can make sense of that question.
No,
I guess
exactly.
What they're asking is
exactly.
They're referring to the development of Whareitane Bay and saying, you know, that was considered as a development as having minor effects and it was passed by the planners, and how is that possible? And what can be done about it?
Yeah, I'll try and sum this up succinctly. Effects, RMA is in many ways an effects-based piece of legislation. Effects on the environment, if they are minor, it's okay. If they are not, then a precautionary approach must be taken. And so what has happened is that we're talking about property rights and property entitlements, I suppose, and so it's in the interest of applicants that everything be minor. How can I put it? In the district plan, there are rules, and they're predicated on effects being minor, and then if they are, everything goes through as quickly as possible. But what the Act actually talks about is cumulative effects, and if we're talking about nature, then we know that cumulative effects over time are extremely important. And unfortunately, the district plan and the focus of the planners often, more often than not, overlooks this. Why is this? Why is there such a focus within the council on getting resource consent through as quickly as possible, and usually on a non-notified basis. There is a good reason for this, and it's come about because for years council planners have been told by politicians, local government politicians, and politicians in Parliament that they must be business friendly, that they must resource consents must go through as quickly as possible. And so there's been years of pressure on this, and what has happened, the pressure has told, and therefore we have a system now in which resource consents go through very, very quickly and on a non-notified basis. There are district plans, a couple of generations of district plans now, and multiple plan changes, which also are along the same trend. And therefore, what we are having now, the results of all of this, is that the environment is being degraded, and the rights of neighbours and communities are also being degraded. This is one of the unintended consequences of this business-friendly ideology when it comes to resource consents.
Right. Okay. So is there something that's fundamentally changed recently? Because it seems like there's a... I mean, I don't know. Maybe it always feels like there's an onslaught. But at the moment, it seems that there's a particular onslaught with lots of developments that are in contravention of what the community might need. So specifically, there's Faratane, which is building into a coastal yard, or, you know, just touching the... Or it is actually in the coastal yard, and right smack up against the reserve. There's the Flying Fox, which is going over the Forest and Bird Reserve. There's the supermarket, which has gone through as a non-notified application. There's possibly the marina, which is ticking away in the background, but no one has mentioned for a couple of months, but I'm sure there's lots of stuff going on around there. These are quite big, significant developments. So is there something that's changed to make all of this easier for people to do?
It's a continuum. This has been going on for years, but the trend appears to be accelerating. And so, yes, we have a number of these things today, not just on the island, but also in the city. At the same time, I think there is a growing awareness and sensitivity in the community. For instance, in the city, in places like Ponsonby and Herne Bay and Greylin, where old heritage buildings are being demolished, that the local neighbours and community are starting to resist this. So two things are happening. The trend is accelerating, but the community resistance is growing, both here and on the island and in the city.
Right. So talking about specific developments then, if you look at Faratane, how has it been possible when you're not allowed to do anything within the coastal yard, which is 40 metres, how is it possible that this development has gone through both non-notified and also just been accepted?
I cannot answer or explain that. The coastal yard was meant to be sacrosanct, though all of this legislation and all of these plans have certain ambiguities, and skilled, forceful planners and developers can exploit these apparent loopholes. That is the only explanation, but it should never have gone through on a non-notified basis. Had it been notified, all of these points in terms of the coastal yard, but also the archaeological value of that place and the natural landscape would have come up during hearings, and if it hadn't worked in the hearings, there would have been the option of bringing them up in a formal environment court appeal. But it went through on a non-notified basis, and that was an absolute scandal.
Right. And now that it's happened, is there any recourse for the community to say that the decisions were made in a way that isn't consistent with... I mean, I know a lot of these things are about interpretation, but is there any recourse that one has without going to the environment court to say these were bad decisions and we want them to be reviewed without following that process?
No, there's no real non-legal way that I can think of. A judicial review, I think, is one option, and I think in the circumstances it's quite appropriate. the stop work that exists over much of the site because of the errors that the consent authorities made in regard to archaeology is still in place. In my view, the what has been constructed should be dismantled. I have, you know, no problem if they want to build their trophy houses further back from the coastal yard, but the structure, the so-called cabana, should really be dismantled. But they have the developers now have been given a legal property right, if you like, in their non-notified consent to go ahead. But I think a judicial review is the best way to go to try and make a lesson of this.
Mm. I understand. Is this judicial review the thing that costs around $20,000 to put together? There is a cost involved in that, isn't there?
Absolutely. When it comes to lawyers, there's always a cost, and that is why the community is tends to be disadvantaged in these situations. You know, the law is equal for everyone, but of course it helps if you've got a lot of money to pay for it. Mm. And of course, more often than not, communities are unable or unwilling to stump up for all that money, which after all would have no guaranteed outcome.
Mm. So is there a role for the community board in this? Can they somehow support or either ensure that such developments are notified in the future and or support the community in some way in supporting the costs of a judicial review?
The local board certainly does have a role. The local boards under the super city have been deliberately underpowered. That has to change. But everyone has the right to speak and vote. And I would like to see the local board come out with an expression of firm opposition to this particular development, but also apply pressure to have their input, their role in resource consents stepped up, and so that if the first stop for a resource consent, especially in the coastal environment, should be the local board. Now, there's another reason why developing in the coastal environment is much more sensitive on Waiheke. Waiheke is covered by the Hauraki Gulf Marine Park Act, which requires a protection and enhancement of all the natural and heritage values, and so that creates a special circumstance. And so I'd like to see the local board take a lead on this. The community's feelings are quite clear, and I know that the local board has been dismayed at what has happened, but I think it needs to come out more strongly and make its position quite known about where it stands.
Okay, so its position in the sense that it's not acceptable to have these kinds of developments that are non-notified. That would be the first thing.
That would be the very first step. They are the elected representatives of this community, and planners should consult the local board in detail in regard to developments in the coastal environment. And I want to say something else here, because with all the fuss that's been created around Whareitana and the publicity that's appeared in the New Zealand Herald and Gulf News and Māori Television in particular, there has been, I believe, something of a change taking place within the council, coming from the chief executive down. I take all these complaints directly to the chief executive, and I think it's having an effect. And one of the results of this, I believe, is that while district plans have been deliberately constructed as I have said earlier, to be as permissive as possible in regard to developments, with all their rules which focus on minor effects, and almost make it's almost impossible to have a major effect in that particular world. There is a section of the Resource Management Act that has been long neglected, and that is Section 94 of the Resource Management Act. Section 93 of the Resource Management Act is all about notification, almost as if the assumption was that just about every resource consent would be notified, though of course that's not really practical. But Section 93 goes on to talk about why you don't have to notify, except when you get to Section 5 of Part 5 of Section 94, and that says, in special circumstances, whatever the district plan says, you can notify. And I believe when it comes to heritage houses, residential 1 and 2 in particular, character buildings in the city, in the city part of this ward, Waitemata and Gulf Ward, that's special. It's special because the public believe it's special. In the Gulf, developing in the coastal environment is special because of the Hauraki Gulf Marine Park Act. That would mean there is a good rational reason to enable all of these consents to be notified because of special circumstances. And what is happening is that Auckland Council has had a legal opinion from Simpson Grierson, and they're saying, of course, Section 94.5 means what it says. It doesn't matter what your district plan says. If the circumstances are special, then you have every right as a consent authority to take this consent out to the public and notify it. I think that's a positive development.
Okay, so that's interesting. The only, and we're just going to, just one more question, and then Steve's here from the Humble Pie Butchery, so he's just going to have a quick word about that. But just before we finish with this particular topic, the issue is really, it seems to me, is catching these things before the horse has bolted. And so is there a way of saying to the planners, we want you to take into account the RMA, these particular clauses, we want you to take into account these particular clauses from the Hauraki Marine Reserve Management, whatever you've just been talking
Hauraki
about there.
Gulf Marine Park Act.
Mm. Yep. And say, we want you specifically to consider these clauses when you make decisions about whether you're notifying or not.
Yes.
And if so, who would be the people that would either prepare that and put that forward?
I think a policy decision from the local board would be very helpful, and that would go forward to the mayor and chief executive, and that would reinforce the legal opinion from Simpson Grierson that in special circumstances a consent should be notified. That would be a direct reversal of a trend that's been going on 15, 20 years now, to make things non-notified, to get resource consent through as quickly as possible.
So that would
be, public in would actually enable much more considered, robust decisions being made around sustainable management of our natural environment.
Right, so that's something very concrete and very specific that the local board could be working on. And I would imagine that the people on the local board, particularly Faye Storer, Paul Walden, Joe Holmes, would know a lot about planning decisions, the Resource Management Act and the Hauraki Gulf Marine Park Act that you've just mentioned.
Yes, well, I know Faye in particular has had long experience in Auckland City Council around resource consents. She was a resort consent commissioner, and she is very familiar with the district plan. But what we are talking about here, we're stepping outside of that district plan, because that district plan was constructed under the neoliberal paradigm of being as business friendly as possible. So until the district plan is changed in the new unitary plan, I think we have to start looking at going back to the Parent Act itself. And with that section 94.5 gives a lot of scope for special circumstances.
Lovely. Okay, thanks very much. And presumably, I mean, you do live on Waiheke, you've had a lot to do with the local board anyway, and you could also be involved in some sort of advisory role, as you also seem to understand how this all works. It seems to me that the knowledge is there, but perhaps the will is a bit lacking.
I think that the local board, many of the members are new to politics. I think they're all good, sound people. Faye is a very experienced political representative. I think there is a will to represent the community and the growing concerns about the community, about degradation and loss of amenity, especially in around the foreshore and coastal environment. So I don't envisage any problems. Paul is a new, enthusiastic member of the board. He's a strong environmentalist. I'd like them all to work together. They've all got different complementary skills, in my view. Work together, representing the Waiheke community. And I think that if we can work together on a harmonious basis and show a unified front to the city, to the Auckland Council, that can only strengthen the position of Waiheke in the super city.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Okay, look.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
Okay. Lovely. Okay, well, we've got Mike back, and one of the decisions that was made by the local board last week was not to consult on the reopening of the Esplanade, in spite of the fact that 53% of the population in the survey decided that they'd rather see it closed to cars. They decided, Auckland Transport Rep suggested that there was no need to consult the community further, and their recommendation was that the road be reopened to cars. So a lot of people felt very disenfranchised, and I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that decision-making process. And there was a question on Facebook, which I'll just read to you. Are you aware of any communities in Auckland who have a good working relationship with their community board? And if so, how is it achieved? Is there a model we could use on Waiheke?
Just come back to the Esplanade. Having nearly 20 years in regional government, was never really involved in these sorts of local decisions, thank goodness. And I know that the Esplanade has been quite a divisive issue on Waiheke, and I don't think Waiheke needs divisive issues. My whole objective for Waiheke is to see harmony and a united Waiheke, and so
yay that
these sorts of issues are not helpful. And I'm kind of surprised that it came back with that kind of recommendation, because it's a 180 degree turn from the earlier decision, and that in itself is unsettling. I wasn't at the meeting, but the local board made its decision, and I respect that. They did it in a democratic way, but because it is a divisive issue, my own personal preference would have been something more of a compromise. Now, this is not really having it both ways. My personal objective would be to try and defuse it as an aggravation or as a source of resentment or embitterment on Waiheke. So it's not really my idea. It was suggested to me by Kevin Martin, actually, and that is to have vehicles going one way on the inner side and the outer side purely for walking and cycling. That's a compromise, but at least it means that both sides of the argument would get something out of it.
I agree. I mean, I think there does need to be a solution that makes the vast majority of people happy, and if that's the decision, then that's great. I think it's interesting that you say that the decision was made democratically. I mean, there was a vote, and three people voted in favour of supporting the Auckland Transport decision, and two people voted against. But in terms of the greater issues around consultation, for me, it doesn't seem to have been particularly democratic. If 53% of the people in a survey say that they want the road closed, the road is closed for a trial period, it then deteriorates to such a point that they decide that no one can really use it, and then their solution is that they're going to open it up to cars and cyclists. That seems indirect, as you say, it seems in direct opposition to what was decided the last time that people had an opportunity to decide. And yes, it was close, 53-47. But on the other hand, you know, people win elections on those kinds of votes, and no one sort of bangs on about how they're not fair. The other issue is, I think, that certain groups, especially people like Cycle Action, have worked really hard to open that route as a you know, greater cycle route, or what do you call it, around the country, and applying for funding to do that. And they've put lots of work in on the grounds that they're meeting the mandate that they get from the survey and the fact the road was closed. So it seems really unfortunate that this decision is being made without consultation.
Yes, I have to agree. I'm just surprised that this decision came out of Auckland Transport, and I happen to be a director of Auckland Transport.
Oh.
No one said anything to me that there was going to be a 180 degree policy shift. And I know that Auckland Transport ironically spends a lot of time consulting with the community. They have a group of liaison people, and they're always at local board meetings, but I think the great weakness in the system is that the operational works people in Auckland Transport tend not to consult with the community, but they don't even consult with the liaison people. So quite often they can be as surprised as we are at some of these decisions. I don't think it's over. I still think there's a chance for a compromise here. I'm actually quite glad that they're going to rebuild that road, because it was something that was bequeathed to us by previous generations, and it would seem strange that in this modern age, with all our technology and wealth, that we can't maintain a road that people built years and years ago.
I agree. I think it is a shame, but I think for me it's an issue around consultation and what are the possibilities for opening that up to consultation. One of the ideas that Paul Warden suggested, which I thought was a fair idea, was saying if there is a basic cost in maintaining the road for any user, whether that be pedestrians, cyclists, prams, cars, trucks, whatever, there's a basic requirement to maintain the road, otherwise it's just going to fall into the sea. And wouldn't it be possible to do that basic maintenance, which will probably take a certain number of months, and then to consult the community on what exactly the community wants, and then put a whole load of options on the table, and then people vote, or the community board make a considered decision, but one that's based on having accurate figures around the cost to opening it to cars and the other users, and take into account things like the TravelWise plan and access to schools.
I think that's sensible enough. I know it has been, it's not a new issue on the island, and there are strong schools of thought for and against, and I know that after it was closed, virtually at every local board meeting there was somebody coming along and complaining that their disabled relative or neighbour who used to enjoy driving around that road was unable to anymore, and it wasn't fair. So there's been quite a lot of pressure coming on from that school of thought. Unfortunately, it's not like it's 80-20 or 90-10, it's very close to 50-50. And when I see an issue like that on Waiheke, it's not the issue that worries me so much, but to see the community divided, split down the middle almost, though, that's a concern. And I think that as elected representatives, we have to try and look for some compromise that will, if not obtaining a consensus, getting the majority of people soundly behind it. And at this stage, it still seems like a 50-50, and that's not good for the bigger picture on Waiheke.
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, is there a way, if people did want to reopen the debate and reopen the notion of consultation, what would the best approach be, do you think? Would that be a thing of, you know, petitioning the board?
I guess so. The board is a democratic body, and they are people who are obviously in close contact with the public, and unfortunately, there are strong schools of opinion both ways. If it went the other way, no doubt at all, there would be all sorts of petitions demanding it be totally opened. And that's why perhaps we know the issues. We know there are two schools of thought on this. I'm not too sure whether further consultation is helpful. What I think is that we need to engineer a compromise that both schools of thought can live with. I'm not too sure, to be honest with you, how you would achieve that now.
I think it's quite interesting because I think you're right. I think it's given rise to a lot of emotive type of talk. And certainly at that board meeting, there was a woman who sort of said, oh, she was part of the minority who didn't like to present to the board, but she felt really strongly that it should be open, etc., etc. And I think it's really about taking things away from particular individuals and particular people who, you know, may or may not want to drive around the Esplanade. And you're right, if the board were capable of sitting down with all the facts, and I think, in fact, being guided by what Tom Ransom has put in the papers, I don't know if you've seen what he's written in the Gulf News this week, but he was saying, well, you know, there needed to be some questions answered in order to inform the board's decision, which was, you know, how much money does need to be invested, you know, how bad is the road, and what's the problem with it. So can we see the geotechnical report for cliff stabilization? Can we see the cost breakdown for the 1.8 million that'll cost to do the seawall repairs, and the additional 200 that they say that will make it safe for cars? Is it in fact 200,000, or is it more? And where are the figures for that? Where's the assessment of effects on Auckland Transport's own school travel plan? So on the one hand, you have a travel plan which is based around the road being closed, and then suddenly you're opening the road. What are the consequences of that going to be? Why was the trial use data not taken in the summer months? And it's true, more kids walk, cycle, more people are out during the summer than they are during the winter. And how will it be funded? So it seems that if the decisions were made with you know, based on a lot of information rather than just somebody saying that they prefer it open or prefer it closed, that would be more useful.
Yeah, all I can say is that I'm rather surprised at the suddenness of the decision and the 180 degree change in the policy towards the Esplanade. I obviously, this issue is not going to go away, and I would urge a compromise solution. I think we all know sufficiently the issues now. It's a matter of not so much further information as let's sit down and try and resolve something here so that the people who want to drive around can, and the people who want to walk and cycle can. I don't believe that's impossible, and I think it would be a very useful exercise in community building if we could somehow sit down, rather than take a zero sum or winner takes all approach. 1 minute it's walkers and cyclists who win, car people lose out entirely. Next minute, in effect, it's the other way around, because if it's two-way, it makes it very risky for walking and cycling, really. So therefore, let's try and hammer out a compromise. Let's get the road fixed, and once it's fixed, let's work out a compromise for the Waiheke community.
Great. And your idea would be that the board works out that compromise.
The board are the leaders of the community, and we need to follow them, and they need to lead.
Mm. And maybe with a little subcommittee. Oh dear. Okay, right. Lovely. So I guess then another issue that I wanted to get you on was transport and integrated ticketing. One of the things that we spent a lot of time looking at is the price of the ferries and the possibility of getting a subsidy and all of these different routes that have been followed, competition, etc., etc. And one of the routes that we were had our hopes on was integrated ticketing as a way of perhaps reducing the costs of tickets to Waiheke and making them more in line with the other ferry prices across the Auckland area. And so I guess my question was, how is that progressing through?
I was surprised to get a complaint from Waiheke complaining not that we were not going to get, sorry, complaining that about not that we're not going to get integrated ticketing, but complaining that we were going to get integrated ticketing and that would cause dreadful delays on people on the ferries. And I thought about it. It seemed counterintuitive to me. But anyway, I was alarmed that if the complaint was upheld, Waiheke wouldn't get integrated ticketing. But I think the concerns of FUG are unwarranted, really. I think we can move people off the ferry just as quickly with integrated ticketing as with manual tickets. And don't forget, not everyone will have a smart card anyway. But we are going to get integrated ticketing on the ferries.
Great. So when is that going to happen, and what are the prices going to be based on? Is it going to result in a change in ticket fares?
No, it will not, because what has happened is that, you'll recall, Sharon, when you first raised this issue about 3 years ago, the hope was that the changes to the Public Transport Management Act, which we were successful in getting through, would enable the regional council at the time, but now Auckland Council, to exert some authority over prices on the Waiheke Ferry. What has happened is that the new government has come in. It has said that it will repeal those sections of the Public Transport Management Act, and as a compromise, they've brought out a public transport operating model, which all the bus companies have bought into. But the problem is, and against my objection, certain routes, including the airport bus service and the Waiheke service, will not be included in the public transport operating model because they are considered totally private and totally commercial. So that's one of the unfortunate aspects.
Oh, and when was that decided?
I can't tell you exactly when. It was decided in Wellington by the government and the various companies involved who've been lobbying the government, including the owners of Fuller's, so Brian Souter, who also owns Howick and East Bus.
Right, so somehow, somewhere, as I'm finding out now, we've been disenfranchised from getting some sort of system where there'd be some sort of equitable transport fees for the Waiheke run.
Yes, if you put it that way, that is correct. The Waiheke fares will stay as they always have been since they began. In the 1920s, they will stay purely commercial. Every now and then, the company will put the fares up, and that will cause widespread dismay. Of course, for the large number of people over 65 on Waiheke. The service is totally free, so it's not all negative. However, I do agree with you. The service is really beyond in terms of cost. The regulator's control, thanks to a decision by the government.
Right. Oh, well, that's really disappointing. I don't really know what to say. That's, you know. Anyway, the other thing I wanted to ask you is around this integrated ticketing. I understood that a French company had won the rights to sort out this ticketing stuff. They were sort of undercut by Infratil, who organised some sort of other ticketing scheme, including the HOP. So is it, what's going on in terms of integrated ticketing, and who's in the driving seat around how this is happening? And also, given what you've just said about Waiheke and integrated ticketing, are we going to be involved in an integrated ticketing scheme or not? There doesn't seem to now be any reason for us to be involved if we're completely commercial and there are no benefits to be gained.
Waiheke will be involved in the integrated ticketing scheme. The benefit will be a seamless transition from ferry to train to bus, the same as anywhere else. In terms of the integrated ticket itself, you will see that it's got itself into pretty rough waters right now. And what actually happened, yes, an international tender was held in, I think it was 2008 or 2009, and Thales, a French company, won the tender. One of the bidders was a local company, Infratil, which is a listed Wellington-based company which owns New Zealand Bus and Wellington Airport and a few other infrastructure investments, including the Shell service station network now. They bid, and they had a system called Snapper, which they were installing in Wellington. Now, Snapper is a Korean technology debit card, so it works on buses, and it can work on buying coffees and all the rest of it. And the benefit is, when you store the money on a debit card, that money goes to the company that owns it. And when it comes to buses, that's quite a lot of money. What happened again, when the new government came in, Infratil lobbied that government, they lost out on the tender, and so they demanded the right to include their own ticket readers on their own buses. And the government approved that, but only on the proviso that those ticket readers would also be able to read the new Thales integrated smart card. Now, this is when starts getting complicated. In some ways, Auckland Transport brought a bit of this on themselves. They sat down with Infratil and said, okay, let's brand your Snapper card in Auckland HOP, because that's the name we want to call the real integrated ticket when it comes along. So that was agreed, but that confused a lot of people, including myself, actually, to a degree. That is not a HOP card at all. It's just a Snapper card called HOP. And so,
okay, well, that's interesting.
You know, so no wonder people are confused, if even I find it sometimes difficult to follow. But what has happened is, in order to comply with the agreement with the government and NZTA and with Auckland Transport, Infratil had to have compliant readers, ticket readers, on their buses by 1st of November. And Auckland Transport has now found out that there's no way in the world that New Zealand Bus and Infratil are going to have compatible readers by 1st of November. And I am beginning to doubt whether they ever could, and whether they even intended that they would do this. I suspect that their real objective was, having lost the tender, that they came up with another strategy, and that was to habituate people to swipe cards, and then when the real one comes along, demand that they keep their swipe card going as well, which is very lucrative, and so that Aucklanders would have to carry around two tickets, and that's not absolutely unacceptable.
Yes, I was wondering about that.
I think that was a cunning plan. I might be misreading it, but it's unacceptable.
Right. Okay. So I guess the very last question, very quickly, was resources on Waiheke. I mean, I don't know if you know anything about this, but if they build a new supermarket if they change the location of the supermarket, apparently, and I don't know if this is true, the supermarket has to give a whole bundle of money to Auckland Council for the rights to do that. And so what I was wondering is, what happens to that money? Is it spent locally on Waiheke, or does it just go into the Auckland Council fund? Similarly with the wharf tax, that there's been money collected, what's been happening to that? I guess what I'm talking about is, when decisions are made around the Esplanade or the supermarket or whatever, and money is there to be spent and allocated, why isn't it possible for the community to have more decision making in how that's allocated?
Well, can I come back to that supermarket? I strongly oppose it being there in the first place.
Oh, hear, hear.
There are all sorts of reasons why it shouldn't be there. And if we're talking about, if we're really serious about sustainable development, plonking a great big supermarket right there, when you've already got a good working supermarket complex right next to the builder's supply, which on Waiheke is probably as equally as important as the food you get from the supermarket, to stick another one up there right on the main road, it just doesn't make sense to me. So that's the first thing. Now, I'm not entirely sure what sorts of money they paid, development contributions they've paid to Auckland Council, but clearly those development contributions, like all development contributions, would need to be spent in the local area to comply with the requirements around development contributions. But I have to say, it's one of the most disappointing thing that has happened. And again, there was no real notification or any consultation. We were just told it was going to be there, and I first really came to my attention in regard to the Pūtakawa trees, but which in many respects are a complete side issue. The fact that this monstrosity is going there
I'm glad you're sort of mentioning that, because to be honest, I feel really disenfranchised around that whole thing. At every stage I'm told, you probably could have written a letter to someone but you didn't, and then it goes to the Environment Court or wherever it went, and then now you can't say anything, and there's never been a space for anyone to say anything, so no one has said anything, and yet so many people are against it. I'm just thinking of the whole of Ostend and how the nature of that changes. Just the road access, just having two lanes there, when you look at where the current supermarket is, and it's got, you know, three lanes coming out of the supermarket area, three lanes going into it, and the supermarket's slightly lower, so it's not thrust upon you every time you go past. You don't have to look at it. Whereas a huge countdown sign in the middle of Ostend, I just feel that just puts me in suburbia, which is not the reason I came to Waiheke, and it really, really annoys me, and I don't think I'm the only one.
It's bloody awful, really. It's been foisted on us, and even myself, one would think would have some inside knowledge or pre-warning, or no, I'm as disenfranchised as everyone else about
it. So is there anything that can be done? I mean, I know it sounds like a bit of a mantra. Can anything be done?
It's kind of harder to argue the Hauraki Gulf Marine Park Act on this one. It's not like the coastal environment or natural area. It's just bad, dumb, bad planning, in which you can imagine this multinational supermarket with all its lawyers and planners have gone in and dealt with the Auckland City Council. They would have been planners and got this underway, again on a non-notified basis. It's not. I don't think it's sustainable, and it may be subjective because you get used to everything in the end, but it certainly doesn't gel with the special nature of Waiheke Island at all. And you're quite right, it will impose a suburban ambience on a key part of the island, a part of the island I think should have been really the civic centre and the place for you know, your medical centre and all the rest of it. And without this is an argument that I stayed out of, but and I certainly don't want to get into it, but my own personal preference would have been rather than a supermarket there, I would have preferred to see the library there and those civic amenities there, and leave Oniroa for tourism and entertainment and all the rest of it. But
right.
I wasn't in that argument. I don't want to raise it, but it just to explain what my thinking is around Ostend.
Right, okay, no, that's interesting. I think the library, it's a bit like don't mention the war,
Don't mention the library.
Yeah, it's like don't mention the library.
You're lucky to get one.
You're lucky to get one, so yeah. The fact that it's going to cost like four times as much as anyone actually needs and is like a huge monolith.
The same old,
you know,
same
the Turnbull
game.
Library is moving up to Waiheke because we asked for a library. Yeah, so don't mention the library. Okay, Mike, thank you so much for coming in. That was really nice to talk to you.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oniroa.